Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 1300 hours GMT on Tuesday the 30th of June, these are our main stories. Reaction from the people of Hong Kong to China's decision to approve a new tough security law for the territory. King Philippe of Belgium expresses deepest regrets for his country's harsh treatment of its one-time colony in Africa. Also... New research reveals why physical play with young children helps set them up for life. Also in this podcast, Cirque du Soleil, the contemporary circus company, says the coronavirus crisis has forced it to go bankrupt. And build, 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 what Britain's Boris Johnson wants for the UK. On this day, the 30th of June, exactly 23 years ago, the former British colony of Hong Kong was handed back to China. There were assurances that the territory would have a high degree of autonomy under a principle known as One Country, Two Systems. But activists protested at Beijing's increasing control. China responded to those protests with a new national security law, which was rubber-stamped in Beijing today. This law looks set to curtail protest and freedom of speech. The pro-democracy politician Claudia Mo summed up the feelings in Hong Kong.
Plenty of anger and frustration. There's also a certain amount of resignation, because Beijing's not just getting more powers, it's actually getting absolute total power when it comes to controlling Hong Kong. They're now talking the maximum penalty could be life behind bars. It's all aimed at turning Hong Kong into a dead city without dissent, without opposition. This is the end of Hong Kong as we know it.
A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman, Zhao Lijian, said China was determined to protect its own territory and interests.
The Chinese government's conviction in safeguarding national sovereignty, safety and developing interests is resolute. Our conviction in implementing the one country, two systems is resolute. Our conviction in opposing any foreign interference into Hong Kong's affairs is resolute.
Here's our correspondent in Beijing, Stephen McDonnell.
As of tomorrow, Hong Kong is going to be a very different city. In Beijing, 162 delegates to the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress have unanimously rubber-stamped this new law, imposing quite strict punishments on certain acts of dissent, certain types of speech, unauthorised protests. They can all now be potentially judged as criminal matters, considered to be secession or subversion, or colluding with foreign forces, potentially meaning lengthy prison sentences. What's more, you know, the Chinese and Hong Kong governments are saying people shouldn't worry about this. The courts are going to handle it. However, the judges presiding over these matters are all to be appointed by Carrie Lam. Now, Carrie Lam is the leader of Hong Kong, who's effectively been installed by Beijing. There's no way she's going to be choosing judges who would be even slightly, you know, likely to go soft on protesters. There's going to be a special branch of the police force dealing with state security matters. Beijing is going to set up a special state security office in the city. And the highest court is not going to be in Hong Kong. Actually, the ultimate right of appeal will go to the same body that's just rubber stamped this legislation through. So it gives you an idea of why people are worried about this.
Stephen McDonnell in Beijing. So is this the end of Hong Kong as an autonomous territory? I asked our Asia Pacific editor, Michael Bristow.
Well, that depends who you listen to. Carrie Lam, the leader of Hong Kong, has just given a video address to the Human Rights Council in Geneva, in which she says basic rights and freedoms in Hong Kong, which differ from the rest of mainland China, will remain. There still will be free speech, freedom to protest, that kind of thing. But already people who criticize the Chinese government are changing their behavior. A political group set up by students, protesters, called Demosisto, has already announced it's going to disband. So already you see people who are saying things previously are deciding they can't say them in the future. So there are certainly some limits on free speech there. And we have to remember that at the moment, we don't even know the details of this law. China still hasn't published them. And the danger is that they're defined so broadly that people will not know when they've crossed a line. And so in order not to cross that line, they won't go anywhere near it. They also might not know whether China will take over jurisdiction of these cases and they will be sent to mainland China. They won't know what kind of sentence they face. So in those circumstances, it's hard to believe that anyone would want to be entirely or completely critical of the Chinese Communist Party without fear that they're going to have a retribution for speaking out.
There's been strong international reaction and criticism. Will that affect China?
I don't think so. I think China all along has indicated that it's not going to listen to other people. It believes Hong Kong is entirely a matter for itself, for its own affairs. And it will carry on regardless. America, the European Union, Britain, the former colonial power, Taiwan, Japan, all spoken out against this law. But I don't think China's going to listen. It hasn't listened in the last couple of months before it brought this law into force. It's not going to listen really in the future.
Michael Bristow. 3 weeks after a statue of King Leopold of Belgium was removed in Antwerp, the current Belgian king has given an unprecedented apology for what he called the crimes committed in its former African colony of Congo. In a letter published to mark the 60th anniversary of Congolese independence, King Philippe said that under the reign of his ancestor, atrocities had taken place. Our Africa regional editor, Mary Harper, told us more.
All colonial experiences in Africa were pretty bad, but the experience of the Congolese was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, about 10 million people are estimated to have been killed during the time that King Leopold II basically treated the country as his own personal fiefdom. And in particular, in rubber plantations, which provided enormous wealth for the colonial power Belgium, the Congolese were treated essentially as slaves. And if they didn't deliver enough rubber, they would have their hands chopped off, or their wives would be taken, or sometimes even their children would have their limbs hacked off. So the Congolese were treated as subhuman, and they feel immense pain about this. Even today in Congo, the way that they speak about those times seems to have traumatized the whole nation almost up to today.
King Philippe has expressed regret. I mean, is that an apology?
Not exactly, no. I mean, he's expressed profound regrets, deepest regrets, but he hasn't gone so far as to give a full apology.
So why
for
not?
Belgium's action. It's possibly, I mean, there have been demands for reparations from the Congolese, so it might be a way of trying to avoid that. Also, maybe just to retain some kind of respect, or minimal respect at least, for his ancestor, King Leopold II. But at the same time, as you mentioned in your introduction, statues of King Leopold are being removed. They're being defaced by protesters in the light of the Black Lives Matter campaign that has arisen after the killing of George Floyd in the United States. So there's a very heated feelings at the moment in Belgium in particular, but also in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
And how do you think they will view this letter? Do you think people in the Congo will be mollified by it? Because you've said already how much they deeply feel past history even now.
I think that, you know, some people will feel it's at least a few steps have been taken along the way, but you get demands that they actually say Belgium, all this wealth that it extracted from Congo should be put back into the country, infrastructure built, other aid projects, more generous aid projects provided. So it's, I don't think they'll see it as going far enough, let's put it that way.
Mary Harper. Build, build, build. Those were the words emblazoned on the podium as the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson gave a speech outlining his plans on how to soften the economic damage caused by the coronavirus. While he admitted that it might seem a bit premature to make a speech about life after COVID-19, he said Britain couldn't continue to be a prisoner of the crisis. He also acknowledged criticism of the government's handling of the pandemic.
I know that there are plenty of things that people will say and we got wrong. And we owe that discussion and that honesty to the tens of thousands who have died before their time, to the families who have lost loved ones. And of course there must be time to learn the lessons, and we will.
Mr. Johnson compared his initiative to the so-called New Deal, the measures in the 1930s in the US to combat the Great Depression. I asked our UK political correspondent Rob Watson whether that's a fair comparison.
Well, I should first of all say, Val, that the clip that we heard just there, you know, was one of the rare moments of Mr. Johnson being sort of a bit down, because this was classic Boris Johnson boosterism, a sort of optimistic talk we associate him. But to get to your question, one can't help feeling it was somewhat unwise comparison of the Prime Minister to have made, because FDR's two New Deals in 1933 and 35 were vast projects involving over 12% of US GDP at the time. What Mr. Johnson is proposing is far more modest, involving less than 0.3% of UK GDP. But look, essentially what Mr. Johnson is saying, he wants to speed up to the delivery of promises frankly made at the last general election, to basically build more infrastructure and more houses, and to do that by somehow speeding up the planning process in the UK.
And what's been reaction? Because, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen with this pandemic, do we?
Well, the criticism of the speech is that it's more about Mr. Johnson trying to change the political weather than anything else, and to move exactly the focus away from the growing criticism of the government's handling of the COVID crisis. I mean, on top of that, there's just a lot of scepticism about such pledges, given that every UK government always promises, doesn't it, Val, to build more homes, schools and hospitals and infrastructure, but rarely delivers on the scale promised. And there's one other thing. Some Conservatives will also think Mr. Johnson is ideologically confused. Is he a low-tax, small-government Conservative, or does he believe in big government? Today he suggested both.
Rob Watson. For decades, the established formula for peace in the Middle East has been based on the creation of an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel, the two-state solution. So, what happens if, as he's promised, Israel's Prime Minister begins annexing large parts of the occupied West Bank this week? Such a move is envisaged in President Trump's Peace of the Century plan, but has been rejected by the Palestinians and much of the global community, who see it as a clear violation of international law. Here's our Middle East correspondent, Yonah Nell.
From Jerusalem, I'm driving towards a distinctive truncated hill, Herodium, an ancient fortress in the West Bank. According to the long-standing vision for peace, this area would belong to a future Palestinian state. But is that just an illusion? The main road signs here aren't for the Palestinian villages, but for Israeli settlements dotted between them, like Tekoa.
We are sitting, as you can see, in the shadows of a hill that looks like a volcano over there, but it's really the Herodium, the place where King Herod died about 2,000 years ago.
Claims to the land go back a long way for Mark Zell of Republicans Overseas Israel, who I meet at his home in Tekoa. He approves of the Trump plan, allocating a third of the West Bank to Israel, but proposing only a limited Palestinian state under strict conditions.
If those conditions were met, I mean, that would basically be Judgment Day and the coming of the Messiah. Is that reasonable to expect to happen in our lifetime? I don't think so. But I think we have to achieve a modus vivendi, a way of living together.
As she makes coffee in her kitchen, Alia Sha'ar, from the nearby Palestinian village called Tekoa, has the same view of Herodium, but a very different point of view.
Of course I believe in the two-state solution, she says. We'd like to live a normal life like any other people on the planet.
At the same time, she knows that's a distant hope. Locals have lost land to the nearby settlements. There are often tense confrontations with Israeli soldiers and settlers. Her main fear is that ripping up past peace deals could create chaos. It fires the last bullet at chances for a Palestinian state, Alia says. I think that there's a great danger the Palestinian Authority will collapse, and that will affect us all.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Dozens of Palestinians and left-wing Israeli activists gather for a protest against annexation in the Jordan Valley. Kochav Shaha is a young waitress from Tel Aviv.
Of course, I'm against annexation because simply I'm a peace person, and I believe this annexation will prevent the peace that I wish to see.
Driving around to do this report, I'm struck by the amount of roadworks. It's becoming much easier to go between the settlements and different parts of Israel. Both the actual and political landscape has changed dramatically since there was a real peace process. Diana Butu, who used to work on the Palestinian negotiations team, says now is the time to acknowledge new realities.
We now have, for the first time, the Israelis officially saying they don't believe in two states. For a long time, we've seen that the Palestinian Authority bought into the idea that there was going to be a Palestinian state, Palestinian freedom. And now they have to reckon with the fact that that's just not going to happen, and instead start devising a new strategy.
Israel is already in full control of most of the West Bank. The changes being talked about mostly have symbolic value. But symbols do matter. And for Palestinians and much of the international community, annexation shows the roadmap is being drawn without them.
Yolande Nel. Political commentators have long believed that social media will play a crucial role in November's US presidential election. But the owners of those sites have been wary about getting too closely involved in policing the content on their sites. But that is changing. First, Twitter began to issue health warnings against some posts by President Trump, and later Facebook took similar action. Now the social media site Reddit has shut down a forum used by Trump supporters. It was one of around 2,000 such groups banned for violating rules against promoting hate. Amazon's live streaming platform Twitch also temporarily banned Donald Trump's official channel. From New York, here's Michelle Fleury.
President Trump and his followers not feeling much love from online media. Twitch, which is a game-centric streaming platform owned by Amazon, said it was suspending the president's account temporarily. Hours earlier, the popular website Reddit also banned a group devoted to Donald Trump with some 790,000 followers, perhaps anticipating a backlash from those who say there is an anti-conservative bias on social media. Reddit said on Monday, to be clear, views across the political spectrum are allowed on Reddit, but all communities must work within our policies and do so in good faith without exception.
Michelle Fleury reporting. They made their protest on the Olympic podium and tell us about black rights then and now.
Racism is running just the same. It's just as systemic today as it was in 68.
The European Union has condemned the expulsion of its envoy to Venezuela and said it'll take reciprocal measures. The statement came after the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, gave the EU ambassador, Isabel Brillanti Pedrosa, 3 days to leave the country. On Monday, the EU announced sanctions against 11 Venezuelan officials, including MPs, a magistrate and a military chief, for acting against the opposition-dominated National Assembly. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, has been following the story.
We have 11 new names to the list of people sanctioned in Venezuela by the European Union. In total, we have now 36 people, so it's not a new thing, but it seems to have touched a nerve with the government there. We have, for example, the head of the National Telecommunications Agency that is accused of blocking websites linked to the opposition. You have high judges from the Supreme Court who took action against, according to the European Union, against democracy, against the National Assembly. And we have also 3 members of the National Assembly, including Luis Parra, who is the man who was with the opposition, changed sides in the beginning of the year, and was elected president of this assembly, which is controlled by the opposition. And that, according to the European Union, was a completely staged election. Parliament was blocked, and the opposition legislators couldn't have access because riot police was outside.
So, Leonardo, is the timing of these sanctions significant, do you think?
Well, they are, because we have elections to elect a new parliament. They are due to happen by the end of December, according to the law. We don't know exactly when they will happen in the second half of the year. But President Maduro is under increasing pressure from the United States. He had lots of sanctions imposed on him earlier this year, on his government and individuals. Now we have the European Union coming up with more sanctions as well. So it looks like he is under pressure. And these elections are very important because the National Assembly is the only official institution in Venezuela still controlled by the opposition. And Juan Guaido is the opposition leader. He is recognized by most of Europe and the United States as the legitimate leader of Venezuela. Why? Because he is the president of the National Assembly. And I think that's what Maduro wants, to take that post from him, to take that sort of legitimacy from him.
Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, talking to Nick Miles. It was a breathtaking moment. Two black American athletes on the podium during the medal ceremony at the 1968 Olympic Games, wearing black gloves, then raising their fists in a potent symbol of resistance and defiance during the playing of the U.S. national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner. The two American sprinters, gold medalist Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who won the bronze, were sent home after the protest because they broke the rules forbidding political statements at the Olympics. Now, a group of American athletes, including John Carlos, are calling for the scrapping of that rule. We'll hear from John Carlos in a moment, but first, the gold medalist Tommy Smith, who reflects on those events half a century ago.
What was going through my mind was, how soon will I get down from this thing? How soon will I be off so I can continue my fight for freedom, my fight for the okay to move forward proactively? Now I must do what is necessary to promote justice and even justice around the world, or sight to the sightless, or sight to the blindness. It was a silent gesture heard around the world, and that's what me and John Carlos was given, is our voices, so people can hear the sound of silence.
Well, racism is running just the same. It's just as systemic today as it was in 68. When you sit back and think about, we're still going through the same trials and tribulations with law enforcement or education or fair housing. Racism is all over the United States. And the law enforcement is just the tip of the iceberg relative to racism being a part of American fabric. But when you sit back and you look at what's happening today, is relative to what we did 52 years ago, being the fact that we was concerned about humanity. What you see out there today is just that, humanity. It's a rainbow coalition, white, black, tall, short, skinny, fat, ugly, rich, poor. Everyone is out there showing their concerns about the ills of this particular society that we have today. Racism is a disease, and we might not be able to wipe racism out, but we have to get a running start to try and deplete it as much as we can.
John Carlos, and before that, Tommy Smith speaking to the BBC. And the Australian sprinter Peter Norman, who won the silver medal in that historic race, showed his support by also wearing a human rights badge on his tracksuit jacket during the medal ceremony. New research into child development spanning almost 50 years has found one major thing that parents can do to improve the future temperament of their offspring. It's not a greater focus on safety or indeed academic learning. And even better, it's free. Stephanie Prentice has been reading into the findings and has this report.
That's the sound of a father jumping onto a mattress as a baby flies high into the air, landing back down happily. And whether it's piggybacking, chasing or tickling, new research from Cambridge University in the UK has found that increased physical play with young children helps them to have greater control over their behaviour and emotions as they grow up. Professor Paul Ramjanhani specialises in education, development and learning at Cambridge. He led the study and he explains why fathers in particular can be a critical part of early learning.
On average, dads tend to play more physically with their children than mums do. In this rough and tumble play, children are getting very excited. They get very emotional and engaged in it. And they're testing out the limits of physical play, testing out what the limits of what's acceptable and what they can manage. So they're learning to control their actions. They're learning to control their emotions in a very exciting situation. And that can have benefits longer term when they're trying to control their emotions in other stressful, challenging situations.
The research, which is based on data from 78 studies in the US and Europe since 1977, also found that physical playtime reduced hyperactivity and behavioural difficulties in children, and it applies to families with single mothers or separated parents.
Children who grow up either with two mums or different family constellations tend to do fine. This isn't telling us anything necessarily specifically about what dads can do and what happens if dads are missing. This is telling us about the involvement of parents. So this is telling us something about physical play, and all parents can engage in physical play.
Professor Paul Ramchandani ending that report from Stephanie Prentice. And to end this podcast, a sad story for those who love the circus. For four decades, Cirque du Soleil has been reinventing the meaning and the experience of the circus. But now the entertainment group, which is based in Canada but features acrobats, musicians and singers from around the world, says it's been forced to cancel shows and lay off performers because of the COVID-19 pandemic. This report by Simon Hancock.
As COVID-19 infections began to take hold in March, the entertainment company based in Canada saw its income vanish overnight. At least six of its Las Vegas shows closed, along with dozens more across several continents. Now, most of its 4,000 performers and technicians are expected to lose their jobs in the restructuring, though the group aims to rehire as many as possible once the global lockdowns are over.
Simon Hancock reporting. Well, I'm going to pirouette off now, but before I go, here's a quick request from the podcast team.
Here's some great news. The Global News Podcast has been nominated for an award, and we need your help and your votes if we're going to win. The Listener's Choice Award recognizes the best UK podcast as voted for by its fans. To cast your vote, head to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. Search Global News Podcast in the search bar, enter your name and email address to verify your details, press submit, you'll receive an email back, just hit confirm, and ta-da, that's it, you voted. The deadline for voting is 12 noon BST on the 6th of July. Just head to britishpodcastawards.com/vote and choose the Global News Podcast.
Thanking you in advance. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Finding the right foundation is harder than ever. Il Makiage makes it easy to find your perfect match online. No store required. With 50 shades of flawless coverage and over 60,000 five-star reviews, the hype is real. Their online quiz uses AI to find your ideal shade in seconds. And with Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. ilmakiage.com/quiz.